It's Greater LA, KCRW's show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Today, you're going to Santa Monica, home of famous beaches, that pier with the giant Ferris wheel. And as you probably know, if you've been here recently, 1,000 people living on the streets. Now, the Santa Monica City Council, like elected officials all over Southern California, are scrambling for solutions to the homelessness crisis.
Ahead of the game, let's see if we can...
Including a new experiment that seems to be working. It's 8 a.m. on a Thursday. About a half dozen nonprofit workers, a social worker, a housing specialist, a substance abuse counselor, they all sit in a windowless conference room. They're talking through a game plan for the day.
She's very mentally ill, and she's a high priority, I think, for us today.
That's Zachary Coyle, program director for this organization that's called The People Concern.
Okay, you guys met Maurice. Is he on there yet?
No.
The team gathered here has a narrow mission. They're not trying to house all the homeless people in Santa Monica, only 37 of them. The 37 most expensive homeless people in Santa Monica. That's right, the most expensive. The ones who cost taxpayers the most in emergency services, who generate the most 911 calls, who cycle from the streets to emergency rooms, clinics, or jails over and over again. Here's Coyle, the program director.
These are the people who are constantly taking up someone's attention. So wouldn't you rather the attention that they're taking up be on a social worker, substance abuse specialist, a physician's assistant, rather than a paramedic, a fireman? We're providing the attention they're going to get either way.
The city of Santa Monica started funding this team 3 years ago as an experiment. They wanted to know if you could find the most expensive homeless people and house them, would it be cheaper than leaving them on the streets? And yeah, I know it sounds callous to talk about people experiencing homelessness in terms of dollars and cents. So to be clear, the idea isn't only to save money. It's also to save lives. The most expensive people also tend to be the most troubled and the most likely to die on the streets without a serious intervention. And now all the numbers are in. Santa Monica's program seems to be working. But there's a twist. It's actually not surprising, because Santa Monica didn't invent this idea. Once upon a time, L.A. did the same thing. KCRW's Anna Scott picks up the story from here.
After that morning meeting you just heard, the team heads out in cars to drive the streets of Santa Monica looking for people on their list. On this day, the guy in charge of the team, Zachary Coyle, and a couple of his colleagues are searching for one man in particular.
He's about 70 years old. He's been homeless for years and years and years. Chronic alcoholic. His memory's not great. He had an apartment of his own once years ago, and he wasn't able to care for it or care for himself. He wasn't eating. He was not letting people come in to help him. And when they came in and did a check, he was really, really in bad shape. And he's like, you know, his story is he's a Haight-Ashbury guy, and he has some amazing stories like Janis Joplin. Who knows if they're true, but they're great stories.
At one point, Coyle drives past someone sleeping in an alley and takes a closer look, but that person's not on the list. As he approaches a corner by a strip mall, he spots the man he's looking for.
And he's here with two other people, two older women who also appear homeless. Do you know them?
Yes. Yeah, we know everybody out here.
He stops the car. One of his colleagues gets out of the back seat.
So yeah, Jen's done this for a while.
The man they're here to see, it turns out, doesn't want to go to a shelter. So a team member asks how he's doing, if he needs anything right now. And this is what the job looks like a lot of the time. Small interactions designed to build trust over time.
Hi, Denise. You want to share anything, Denise?
I'm trying to be okay. You know, I'm having a hard time.
Coaxing someone off the streets can take days, months, or years. It can seem like a lot of effort for a little payoff, but it does seem to be paying off. Since 2016, this team has placed 19 people in permanent housing, about half their list. And a recent study by the RAND Corporation, a research organization, finds that it is saving the city money. The study says Santa Monica spends about $600,000 a year on the team, but eliminates enough 911 calls to offset up to about 40% of that. The study predicts the savings will grow. And actually, that's not unexpected, because about 10 years ago, LA County did a very similar experiment. It was called Project 50, and it focused on the 50 most vulnerable, most expensive people on Skid Row.
You know, I was like basically an everyday drinker. I would go to bed with it. I would wake up with it. Alcohol was my liquid diet. That was my best friend.
Ed Givens was in his mid-50s back then. He'd been homeless on Skid Row for more than 20 years, and he got 911 called on him a lot.
I started getting in trouble, in and out of jail. I've been to the county jail, Los Angeles County Jail, 50 times. I've counted, I know, 50 times.
One night, Givens was sitting on the sidewalk when the Project 50 staff approached him. They said, "We can help you.
You know, we can get you off the streets, provide you with housing, medical team, you know, counselors, you know." So I kind of like listened to them, but basically, like, it pretty much went in one ear and out the other.
Givens had heard this kind of spiel before. Still, the same people kept coming back, especially one social worker named Rachel.
She would not leave me alone. You know, she was just so persistent. You know, I guess she, I don't know what it was with her, but I guess she saw something in me that I didn't see in myself.
Just like the team in Santa Monica, Project 50's outreach group included social workers, housing specialists, mental and medical health care professionals, laser-focused on a small group of tough cases. So where did this idea come from?
The way the whole thing started was back in 2007.
Former L.A. County Supervisor Zev Yaroslavsky came up with Project 50.
I went to my son's law school graduation back in New York and took advantage of being in New York to meet with a group called Common Ground, which actually housed the people who were homeless on Times Square.
Common Ground is a New York nonprofit. They were early pioneers of an idea that's more widely accepted now, that in order to solve homelessness, you have to start by giving people homes instead of requiring them to get sober, get counseling, or get a job first. That meeting led to Project 50 starting as a 2-year pilot program.
It was designed to see if it would work. And if it worked, we'd build it, expand it. And if it didn't work, we'd junk it. Well, it worked.
But it wasn't perfect, and it wasn't always pretty. It took longer to get people into housing than the Project 50 team planned, and they ended up expanding their list of 50 names to more than 100. Newspaper reports from the time described some of the people in housing going back to the streets to buy drugs or panhandle. Project 50 supporters said, yes, this is messy work, and it could take a long time and a lot of setbacks to stabilize some of the people on their list. But the experiment did seem to work. In 2009, a county analysis found that over 2 years, Project 50 cost $3 million, but saved $3.2 million in hospital visits, jail stays, and emergency services. So Zev Yaroslavsky wanted to expand it beyond Skid Row. But when the expansion plan came to the Board of Supervisors in May 2009...
I couldn't get a second vote on the Board of Supervisors to take it countywide. Some people, you know, at least one member, did not think that taxpayer money should be spent to house people who were on drugs or who had an alcohol problem. Well, if that's the attitude, then we're going to have a growing number of homeless on the streets. And everybody had their own reasons, and there's no reason to rehash all of that.
But let's. Because while Project 50 was one small effort, it was a solution that showed promise. So what exactly happened?
While we're talking about the expansion of 500, which is all well and good, got a lot of other things going on.
The country was in the midst of a recession, and some supervisors, like Don Canabi there, worried about the upfront costs. Another former supervisor, Gloria Molina, worried that the county was taking on a job that technically belonged to state officials, housing the mentally ill.
We have to be cautious here. Because it is different than children. The children are our wards by virtue of our responsibility under children's services. Now, the issue of mentally ill has not yet been defined as our county responsibility.
The only supervisor from back then who's still on the board today, Mark Ridley Thomas, said at the time that expanding Project 50 was premature.
The readiness that I think we ought to have to push forward doesn't seem to have materialized at this point.
In the end, instead of expanding Project 50, the supervisors shelved it. That was the end of it for county officials, but not for the people at the center of the experiment. Like Ed Givens, it took social workers more than 2 years to convince him to go into housing.
You know, I like to say that, and I always say this, you know, Project 50 actually literally saved my life.
Givens still lives in a permanent supportive housing project downtown, run by a nonprofit the county used to house Project 50 clients, the Skid Row Housing Trust.
Since I've been here, I've been clean and sober for 10 years. Basically, I was just tired, just sick and tired of being sick and tired. But 21 years is a long time. It was to the point where I wanted to stop, but I just didn't know how. With Project 50, I had so much support.
Ultimately, Project 50 targeted 133 people on Skid Row. 2 years after the program ended, a little more than half of them lived in permanent supportive housing like Ed Givens. But besides Givens, the Skid Row Housing Trust was not able to provide any information about how many of them are still there today, despite numerous requests.
Okay, we can go by there.
Back in Santa Monica.
So we're going to go by our drop-in center. We got a call that one of our clients that we're concerned about is there right now.
It's a young guy in his late 30s with serious health problems from drinking.
And we've had him in different shelter beds for a while, and he just kind of flouts the rules when he's in his cups.
Yeah.
Even though Project 50 came and went, the ideas behind it have shown up in programs and policies around LA County, like this one in Santa Monica. Some of the same challenges also live on. I asked Coyle if research shows that this approach saves money and lives, why don't more places do it?
Why do you think this hasn't become a kind of standard template for dealing with this most difficult part of the homeless population?
Oh, gosh. You know, I think it is hard to look at the amount of money that it costs. I think sometimes we have a hard time looking at the troublemakers, quote unquote troublemakers in our society, and say, let's spend money on you. I think sometimes it feels to some people like we're rewarding bad behavior.
The Santa Monica City Council recently extended the team for 2 more years. For KCRW, I'm Anna Scott.
We're always online at this program, kcrw.com/greaterLA. You can check out the podcast, too, wherever you get your podcasts. They drop every day, and, well, we'd love to have you subscribe, so do that wherever you get your podcasts. Coming up on the program, with nuclear power on the decline and a large, now shut-down nuclear plant right down the freeway, what do you do with all that nuclear waste? You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
You're back with Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiatakis. On the 5 freeway between Los Angeles and San Diego, and between that stretch of interstate and the Pacific Ocean, sit two large white domes. Those are covers to the reactors at the San Onofre Nuclear Generating Station. Now, the plant hasn't generated power for more than 7 years after a slew of replacement steam generators failed in 2012, a big story at the time.
Officials say the leak is small, but as we've seen before, sometimes nuclear plants have changed the story after an accident.
Now, the story did change the following year. Instead of coming back online after temporarily shutting down, the companies that operate San Onofre, Southern California Edison, and San Diego Gas and Electric, decided to nix it for good.
After 45 years, the San Onofre nuclear plant is shutting down for good. Thanks for joining us.
But what's happened to the 3.5 million pounds of nuclear waste still sitting on that site? A site that within a 50-mile radius, millions of people live. Utility officials have been transferring all that waste, from its wet pools into canisters to put into dry storage. But then something happened almost a year ago that put a stop to that. A 50-ton canister of radioactive nuclear waste got dangerously wedged inside a storage cavity, and it was left suspended and unsupported for up to an hour. Well, this week, after getting the thumbs up from federal officials, Edison announced it will restart transfer operations of all that waste. And here to bring us up to speed on this story and to talk about the future of nuclear waste removal and nuclear power in general is Greg Yasko. He was chairman of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission from 2009 to 2012. Greg, thanks for being with us.
Well, it's a pleasure to be with you.
You bet. We talk about nuclear waste. What exactly are we talking about? I mean, what's inside these heavy canisters of spent, I guess we call it spent fuel, right?
Yeah, so the spent fuel itself is kind of like a pencil-thin rod of what used to be primarily uranium and is now a mixture of lots of other different kinds of materials, most of which at this point are radioactive.
Really, it's pretty dangerous stuff, what's inside these canisters.
Yeah, the material that's in there would give you enough radiation to cause you to die if it weren't shielded. And so it needs to be behind some type of material. Water does a good job of shielding the radiation. Concrete, very thick metals can do that as well. So it needs to be protected because it is material that's very, very hazardous.
As I mentioned, reports are that there's about 3.5 million pounds of that waste at San Onofre. Where are they keeping all that stuff?
Well, right now, there's a combination of places. There's something called a spent fuel pool, which is basically a big, giant pool of water where this fuel goes to after it's been in the reactor. And, of course, the reactors are shut down, so all that fuel has been moved into this pool. And from the pool, it then goes into what's called dry cask storage, which is basically a way to store this fuel that is not in water, that's in some type of concrete bunker, essentially. And the ones at San Onofre right now is a newer type of system that takes this fuel and puts it into kind of a concrete bunker that's underground.
So what went wrong with the process a year ago?
Well, all of this involves very heavy materials. You have these shielding containers that, as I said, help partially shield the radiation. And so you have to lift this material with cranes or other devices that can lift very heavy objects. And when they were taking one of these canisters and lifting it up to put it into the hole in the ground where it would go, it got jammed and got wedged a little bit. And that prevented it from going directly in the ground the way it was supposed to. And that's not something you want to see.
We've heard all about nuclear fuel, spent fuel being moved about the country by train or by truck or, you know, whatever means possible. What about this stuff? Is it going to stay at San Onofre? Are they going to move it somewhere else?
Well, right now there is no place to move it. And that, I think, is one of the biggest challenges that the community is facing in San Onofre is the system that's there for this fuel is not really designed to store it permanently. It's really only designed to store it for a couple of decades, and then it could be reevaluated and maybe last a little bit longer. But it's really not a system that's there to store it for hundreds of years or thousands or even the close to a million years that it needs to be isolated from the environment. So it's really kind of a very confusing situation where you've got this fuel that needs to be stored for almost a million years, and we're putting it in a place where it's really designed to be stored for a couple of decades.
I'm going to play Captain Obvious here and say we live in a seismic zone here on the west coast of the United States of America, and something could happen. There could be an earthquake. We had a couple of earthquakes a couple of weeks ago right here, big ones in Southern California. What happens if something is close to the plant, to this decommissioned or future decommissioned plant, and all that spent fuel is there? Or there's a tsunami a la Fukushima in Japan.
Yeah, the two biggest worries you have with this material is one is kind of a long-term slow release of radiation, and that would happen through corrosion as the canisters that are designed to hold the fuel start to corrode, and then the fuel itself starts to corrode, and then that leaches out into the groundwater in and around the site and potentially then into the ocean. So you have that potential, which could come certainly if you had the site inundated by a tsunami. You had some type of earthquake that could change where the water table is and move the water levels higher. These canisters could fail, and with that, you could get a more significant release of radiation. But the most likely concern is really this long-term release of radiation into the environment as all of these materials corrode and really outlive what is, as I said, a very short expectation for the lifetime of this storage facility.
Let's talk about the plant, because you say it is shut down and it's in the process of being decommissioned. What does that mean, decommissioned?
So it essentially means you clean it up. You take all the buildings, you tear down all the buildings, you remove all the material, and you return the site to the condition that it was in before the plant was ever built. And that's a process that can take a long time, partially because a lot of the materials that are in that plant have become essentially radioactive or emit radiation now as a result of being in this radioactive environment for so long.
You were in Washington in the Obama administration at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission when this incident, when the steam generators and the failures of those began in 2012, and then of course the decision ultimately to shut it down for good. What was going through your mind when all of that was happening? I mean, you had sort of an inside view of what was going on, and you know, were you like, oh boy, this is really bad?
Well, it really was a bad situation. This was really a failure on so many parts of the industry, and unfortunately, I think on the agency as well, because what happened there was they put in a new steam generator. That steam generator was not well designed, and the steam generator is important because it is what we call a safety barrier. So it is one of those areas in which you've got, on the one side, you've got radioactive materials, and on the other side, you've got the clean environment. So when that steam generator ruptured, and it's basically a big system of very thin tubes, you actually were releasing radiation to the environment. And unfortunately, what I saw was really an effort not focused on trying to understand what went wrong and why it went wrong, but really an effort that was very much focused on trying to get the plant restarted, trying to bring power back, trying to basically start generating revenue again, because that's ultimately what happens when you generate power. And the more I saw of that, the more I realized that that was just a mistake.
I mean, essentially what you're saying, though, is these companies, these utilities, these for-profit utilities are saying, you know what, we want to generate electricity through the nuclear process. It's going to make us money. Maybe we're not going to be quite so, you know, like to the letter about everything that's going on. And maybe we don't know what's going to happen in the future. I mean, that sounds really risky.
You know, with this particular situation, they had an opportunity with this new design to send it to the NRC, to have the NRC review the design, and they chose not to do that. That turned out to be something, of course, that was a mistake, both from just an operational perspective, but also ultimately from really a regulatory perspective. They really should have sent the design to the NRC, or the NRC really should have reviewed the design. And perhaps the NRC would have identified the problems with it before they installed it, and the incident never would have happened. But that would have slowed down the process, it would have cost money, and it would have potentially found that the design was not acceptable. So they chose not to do that. And I think that was a mistake, certainly from a safety perspective. And at the end of the day, it turned out to be a mistake from an operational perspective because it wound up destroying the plant.
I mean, what does that tell us about operating those plants safely in the future? Is nuclear power still an option, do you think, going forward as a clean energy source, quote unquote clean?
Yeah, I mean, nuclear is really not an option in this country anymore. We have about 100 plants right now, 98 plants operating. Most of those plants are getting close to the end of their operational life, or they'll probably see that in the next 15 to 20 years. And many of them are simply too expensive. They're more expensive to operate than new sources of clean energy like wind, solar, hydro. So the future of nuclear in this country is really one of a declining industry, a contracting industry over time. And as a former safety regulator, of course, that in my mind raises a lot of concerns, because as the industry contracts, as the price pressures get even stronger and greater, the chance of having incidents becomes even more significant.
Nuclear energy may not be generating electricity, but certainly all that spent fuel is still there and will be there for decades, millennia. Greg Yasko, who is chairman of the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission, also author of the book Confessions of a Rogue Nuclear Regulator. Greg, thank you for your time.
It was a pleasure.
That's it for today. Next week, broken sidewalks and spawning grunions. I sure hope you'll come along. Coming up next, it's The Bookworm and story time. Catherine Barnes, Sonia Guise, Phil Richards, Ray Guarna, Christian Bordahl. They make up our dream team. I'm Steve Chitakis. Have a great day. Thanks for your ear. Take care.